Universität Hamburg.
Lewis is The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, which is the first novel published in the sequence, and in fact about a specific moment, so I apologise if you want a whole discussion of Narnia. And second, that I am in fact talking about the 1949 novel and not any of the visual versions, despite the title of this sort of brought together panel. So you may be wondering why I would evoke a term like magic realism in discussion of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, which is a text clearly identifiable as children's fantasy. Indeed, as Farah Mendelssohn indicates in Rhetorics of Fantasy, the classic portal fantasy in British literature. I do not at all wish to suggest that the novel is not a portal fantasy. The passage from one world to another, the quest structure and rhetorical devices identified by Mendelssohn in her analysis of portal fantasies are clearly visible here. Rather, I wish to examine the ways in which Lewis's establishment of the portal situation, and in particular his location of his young protagonist's perspectives on that event, can be deployed to illuminate other aspects of the fantastic tradition more broadly, with possible implications for more recent British writing and its reception. As the rich variety of papers at this conference has already demonstrated, and I think particularly these last two, the fantastic may be conceived in very different ways, and may encompass fantasy literature and even science fiction, or may more narrowly, as by Todorov, be distinguished from the marvellous and the uncanny in ways that would exclude much writing we now consider fantasy. I seek to illuminate the strategies by which certain fictions have been located for their readers in order to consider developments in contemporary deployment of the fantastic. And I should explain that originally I had planned to include some analysis of the later texts I'm talking about. That isn't here, so there's a hole in the paper and I'm happy for you to tell me about it. For those who may not be familiar with The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, well, maybe, how many people have not encountered that narrative? Okay, great. That's half a minute saved. Okay. So, one of the many terms evoked in attempts to define the fantastic in relation to other modes is magic realism, an approach to the fantastic historically associated with developments in fiction from Latin America. Indeed, discussions of magical realism have focused on its context as much as, or more than, its content. Some scholars, notably the founding theorist Angel Flores, suggest that it can properly be ascribed only to a Latin American context, or at least one not dominated by a Western rationalist viewpoint, later critics have suggested. Others have suggested that magic realism is found in situations involving oppression to which it responds. It's been pointed out that writers such as Gabriel Garcia Marquez deploy fantasy and magic realism in order to convey facts about governmental oppression without attracting official attention and imprisonment or worse. Magic realism thus becomes a subversive strategy, and critics such as Maggie Bowers locate a novel like Angela Carter's Nights at the Circus as magic realism, despite Carter's Western British context, precisely because Carter is reacting to patriarchal oppression, even though it is arguable that speaking explicitly against patriarchy was both legally and socially possible in 1980s Britain when the text appeared. Lewis's depiction in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe of his character's experiences on entering the wardrobe, though not subsequently, interestingly evokes precisely the distinctions proposed by such theorists as Amaril Shanadi for interpreting a text as magical realist. I apologise if I'm saying these names incorrectly, by the way. First, the text provides its readers with a world that appears to be continuous with that experienced by Western rationalist thinkers. The narration explicitly invokes a world that is shared by its readers. Quote, "This story is about something that happened to four children when they were sent away from London during the war because of the air raids," unquote. This is what Shanadi calls a convincing level of verisimilitude, as she explains her preconditions for magic realism. Lewis's narrator assumes that in a novel published in England in 1949, his immediate readers will know what the war was and will at least have heard of air raids, possibly even experienced them. This is not apparently an opening either to a fantasy novel beginning in another world, the fairy tale or the marvellous, according to traditional classifications, or an immersion fantasy in Mendelssohn's. The narrator speaks to the reader of the known, inviting the expectation of conventional realism. So fantastic elements in the text must be considered in relation either to the uncanny, the fantastic in the narrow sense, the magic realist, or to intrusion or portal fantasy. The attitudes of the child characters in the text illuminate possible responses to the situation of the novel, and thereby open up alternative ways to classify that situation. Crucially, Lucy, the child who initially enters the wardrobe and discovers Narnia, is completely accepting of her experiences once she can construct a coherent worldview from them. The moment of transition is disturbing, potentially uncanny. Lucy is puzzled by the discovery of, quote, something soft and powdery and extremely cold underfoot, instead of, quote, the hard, smooth wood floor of the wardrobe, prompting her to observe, this is very queer. The moment of passage also confuses the narrator, who is focalising through her and who comments that a light is visible far off, quote, not a few inches away, where the back of the wardrobe ought to have been. Both Lucy's comment and the narrator's point to a disjunction in her experience that in rational terms requires explanation. She is experiencing, from this point of view, the supernatural. However, the elements of what is confusing in her experience immediately lend themselves to a rational synthesis that does not, in the narrator's view, require further analysis. Quote, something cold and soft was falling on her. A moment later, she found that she was standing in the middle of a wood at night time, with snow under her feet and snowflakes falling through the air. The anomalies in Lucy's experience appear to be resolved by this discovery. The narrator's description again points to an experience that is recognisable and recognised. Its only oddity is in its juxtaposition with Lucy's state a few moments before. She has not been outside in a wood, but inside in a wardrobe. It was a rainy morning, is now night time. It was a climate and time lending itself to holiday and exploration, therefore summer, not the season for snow. Lewis has created a situational and indeed tactile reversal. Instead of the soft warmth of the fur coats Lucy expects in the cupboard, she feels, quote, something hard and rough and even prickly that she identifies as just like branches of trees. In other words, the juxtaposition of the two spaces produces a complete reversal in Lucy's experience that is at odds with the conventional rational experience. As Shanadi observes of the fantastic, quote, the worldview coincides with our own and is threatened by an event which does not fit into the logical code expressed by the rest of the text. The two worlds proposed by Shanadi as posited within fantastic and especially magic realist texts are very vividly present, but they are contiguous rather than overlaid in this case, as Lucy's surprise, a common reaction in the fantastic, makes clear. But Lucy's attitude towards the transformation in her environment makes evident that she is not a rational, sceptical Western adult. After the confusion of transition, she is fully accepting. That is, once the narration locates her as in a new space, she found she was standing in the middle of a wood, she is no longer puzzled, and the narration proceeds on the basis that her experience is factual. Lucy's ready acceptance locates her as similar to a character in a magical realist rather than in the Todorovian sense of fantastic text, because in a fantastic text, the presence of the two worlds, the natural world in which the events of the story commence and the supernatural world that in some way intrudes on or appears within it, remains unexplained, and in Todorov's view produces a hesitation within the reader, a hesitation generally, though not always, replicated in the character's own experience, and that is never resolved within the narrative. As suggested by Shanadi, in a magical realist text, the antinomious relationship between the two worlds is resolved by the character's unquestioned acceptance of them as in effect one world. The character's belief system does not differentiate between what Shanadi calls the logical codes of the two, so there is no perception of conflict or suspicion of the uncanny. The origins of magical realist texts, as so named, affirm this view. The belief systems of American Indians in Latin America, the original home of magic realism, allow for the presence in the world of elements that from a Western rationalist viewpoint would seem impossible, for example, levitation, ghosts. And magic realist writers, whatever their own beliefs, represent these events as believed by characters from such contexts. It is noteworthy that Lewis's treatment of his narrator in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe is not entirely consistent in the novel. While the children, especially Lucy, are frequently focalisers for the narration, in effect locating the narrator as sharing not only their experiences but also their worldviews, the narrator also has a distinctive and frequently didactic personality that suggests a potentially different relationship to the nature of events. When Lucy enters the space beyond the wardrobe, for instance, the narrator comments in parentheses, quote, she had, of course, left the door open, for she knew that it is a very silly thing to shut oneself into a wardrobe. The of course makes clear that this is narratorial comment rather than report of Lucy's own thought. Later, the narrator will twice comment similarly and in similar language on Edmund, who does foolishly shut the door, and on Peter, who does not, so that the comment becomes a kind of running joke as well as a guide to characterisation. As such, that is the running joke, it is also representative of the narrator's own perspective as a somewhat minatory older person who is not only well-versed in the ways of the English rational world, but wishes to remind and even instruct his readers in those ways as well. The narrator's obvious seniority and fluency in British customs, and even such phrases as in the heart of the country early in the text, places him, and I use that pronoun deliberately, in the same position as Shanadi's implied author of magical realist works. Quote, The author of a magico-realist narrative implicitly presents the irrational world as different from his own by situating the story in everyday reality, using learned expressions and vocabulary, and showing he is familiar with logical reasoning and empirical knowledge. The term magic refers to the fact that the perspective presented by the text in an explicit manner is not accepted according to the implicit worldview of the educated implied author. What differentiates The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe as a whole from magical realist texts is that despite Lucy's acceptance and the narrator's endorsement of her perceptions, the status of the second world, Narnia, is challenged within the text. And I'm still talking about the first section because obviously it changes after that. In magical realism, the supernatural or irrational is not presented as problematic. Shanady argues that, quote, although the educated reader considers the rational and the irrational as conflicting worldviews, he, this time it's her pronoun, does not react to the supernatural in the text as if it were antinomious with respect to our conventional view of reality, since it is integrated within the norms of the perception of the narrator and characters in the fictitious world. The reader of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, however, encounters conflict within the text as the other children question Lucy's experience precisely because it does not cohere with their worldviews. It is significant here that Lucy is the youngest child of the four. She has not been fully indoctrinated into the expectations of her society. Thus, her initial confusion about the anomalies she encounters is readily resolved when she can rename her situation as in the middle of a wood on a snowy evening rather than in the back of a wardrobe on a rainy morning. By contrast, Peter and Susan, the eldest of the children, have reached a stage where their understanding of reality is fully shaped by Western post-Enlightenment culture. As a result, they are sceptical. Peter, a generous brother, is prepared to accept that Lucy is, quote, making up a story for fun, and why shouldn't she? But not to believe in the reality of that story. When Lucy leads the way back to the wardrobe crying, now go in and see for yourselves, none of them see Narnia. Susan pulls the coats aside and declares, it's just an ordinary wardrobe, look, there's the back of it. And all four then examine the wardrobe and find a perfectly ordinary wardrobe. Significantly, quote, Peter went in and wrapped his knuckles on it to make sure that it was solid. An action that simultaneously appears to endorse the possibility of some truth in Lucy's story and manifests Peter's adherence to Western rationalist modes of thought, in which we habitually test our hypotheses and, as Samuel Johnson demonstrated in his refutation of Berkeley, we appeal to the reality of the senses. When Peter and Susan go to Professor Kirk, the owner of the house, for advice on Lucy's story, they do so out of the fear that she is not merely lying, but deluded, crazy in fact. They fear that she has adopted a worldview that is not consistent with reality. Interestingly, Lewis presents the conversation as a debate which the professor wins because of his superior rationality. The professor's defence of Lucy depends on an analysis of possibilities. Quote, logic, said the professor half to himself. Why don't they teach logic at these schools? There are only three possibilities. Either your sister is telling lies, or she is mad, or she is telling the truth. You know she doesn't tell lies, and it is obvious that she's not mad. For the moment then, and unless other evidence turns up, we must assume that she is telling the truth. The designation of their counsellor as professor, he is physically stereotyped to the point of caricature in fact, his appeal to logic and his denigration of the schools Peter and Susan presumably attend for not teaching it, all locate the professor as the epitome of the Western educated rationalist, precisely the kind of figure postulated in Shunady's analysis as the implied author of a magical realist text. The fact that the professor's conclusion supports Lucy's truth-telling, however, startles the children. Susan looks to check that he is not making fun of them and provides a bridge between their rationally informed scepticism and a belief in the possibility of Narnia. Thomasino has in fact written about the rationality of the debate and the intellectual options available to Peter and Susan in the volume The Chronicles of Narnia and Philosophy. Thus, when all four children are hiding from tourists in the dark of the wardrobe, they repeat Lucy's experience of anomalies. Quote, there's something sticking into my back, said Peter, and isn't it cold, said Susan, and must finally concede that I do believe that we've got into Lucy's wood after all. Rationality has led to the possibility of credence, and so apparently to the actuality of crossing between the two worlds. What we've seen in these two portal crossings then, and I'm sorry I haven't space here to talk about Edmonds, is two different types of fictional strategy. In the first case, Lucy's reaction provides a hint of the fantastic, this is very queer, that is immediately resolved and thus becomes, in effect, magic realist. Her own ready trust that her senses will show a real world precludes doubt of the existence of the supernatural. Peter and Susan, on the other hand, begin like the respondents in some fantastic texts, in the narrow sense, sceptical auditors who do not accept the reality of supernatural events that may be described to them by the protagonist. Their own dependence on rationality, evidenced in their initial approaches to the wardrobe, pulling aside the coats, knocking on the back of the wardrobe, and in their doubts of Lucy's sanity, is then converted by their respect for the superior rationality of the professor and his logic into openness to belief. Thus, when they enter the wardrobe and discover themselves in Narnia, there is no moment of doubt. Quote, "I do believe we've got into Lucy's wood after all," says Peter. And all four children proceed straightforwardly to act entirely on the basis that their experiences of Narnia are indeed experiences of reality. Since they remain in Narnia till near the end of the text, its supernaturalness or incongruence with reality become no longer at issue. We are then within the fantasy world. But rationality itself, paradoxically, has opened the path to belief. Indeed, it has apparently opened the path to Narnia itself, as it is only when they have listened to the professor's arguments that entry into the wardrobe leads to entry into Narnia. I say it has apparently led to this, at least in the logically dubious post hoc ergo propter hoc fashion, because such a reading provides a way for the educated reader to master the events of the text. We know that Lewis was a Christian, and indeed a Christian apologist who wrote a number of books as well as giving radio talks. And it is possible to read on the subject of Christianity, and it's possible to read the Chronicles of Narnia, including and indeed especially The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, as another version of such apology. Lewis himself had written to a friend after publication of his earlier science fiction novel, Out of the Silent Planet, that the apparent ignorance of Christian references by his reviewers was an advantage for evangelization because, quote, any amount of theology can now be smuggled into people's minds under cover of romance without their knowing it. It is noteworthy that Lewis later deployed precisely the professor's argument, bad, mad or telling the truth, in his defence of the status of Christ as Son of God in his book Mere Christianity. This defence, known as Lewis's trilemma, impressed his many lay followers and subsequent apologists, although contemporary theologians don't uphold it on the basis that Jesus did not in fact claim to be Son of God. Anyway, reading The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe as a smuggling of Christian stories under cover of romance, we can infer that Peter's and Susan's entry into Narnia is facilitated by their new willingness to believe in its possibility, an openness to faith, in fact. This takes us back to Bauer's suggestion that magical realism emerges in situations of oppression. Lewis's well-attested sense that England was in decline because of modernity and secularism, his concern with hostility towards Christian faith, results in his desire to smuggle theology into people's minds under cover of romance. This locates him as, at least in his own mind, an oppressed figure attempting to convey truth in a space not open to such statements. My point in analysing the first section of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe in these terms is not to propose, as I said, that it should be considered as a magical realist text rather than fantasy. The fantasy world entered by the children is depicted as contiguous with the ordinary world rather than coherent with it, and the Fawn's identification of Lucy's origins when she tells him, quote, "I got in through the wardrobe in the spare room," as, quote, "the far land of spare where eternal summer reigns around the bright city of wardrobe," comically provides a way for the reader, certainly the child reader, to accept the location of Narnia as another country, if an oddly reached one. Rather, by analysing the attitudes of characters and narrator in relation to the operation of magical realism as theoretically conceived, I wish to highlight the implications of Lewis's subversive deployment of the rational against itself for more recent Western fiction. Fantastic elements have become a major aspect of contemporary postmodernist fiction by Western writers, including British writers like Carter or Jeanette Winterson, as well as writers like Salman Rushdie, whose case is more complicated in that he does draw on Indian conceptions of the world as well as Anglo-European ones. Within texts by these writers, the reality of events we might elsewhere consider non-natural, supernatural, irrational, is rarely questioned, as in magical realist texts, yet their readers accept these whether or not they've heard of magical realism or those earlier texts. I would suggest that this is partly due to the children's fantasy tradition and specifically to writers like Lewis. In the opening panel at this conference, several participants wondered why the fantastic, in the broad sense, seems to have undergone such a cultural revival, a sociological question, as was pointed out, but one that may have specifically literary answers, as well as others of the kind touched on in Thursday's discussion and also pointed to by Brian Stableford in Friday's keynote. Robert A. Collins argued in his 1982 essay, Fantasy and Force Structures, The Effect of Philosophical Climate Upon Perceptions of Fantasy, that whether texts are perceived as fantasy or reality depends on the intellectual historical context within which they are read. Collins suggests, for instance, that Spencer's Fairy Queen is not classifiable as fantasy because the events and characters depicted there were largely similar to those depicted in most other works of the period. They were therefore taken as natural within literature. I suggest that we can extend Collins' argument to consideration of the cultural context of most more recent postmodern texts. Children's literature has long been a rich site for fantasy, perhaps because of the comparative openness of children to belief. Thus, at least since the Enlightenment, folk tales and fairy tales have increasingly been seen as the province of children. Lucy's ready acceptance of the reality of Narnia derives from her childish innocence. She has not yet been inculcated into the expectations of Western rationality. Peter and Susan must in effect return to that state in order to believe, to enter the fantasy world that is Narnia. They must become as a little child in Christian terms, and no doubt this is Lewis's message. But Lewis's dramatisation through them of this process as happening by way of rationality, their rational scepticism transformed into potential belief through reason itself, is a significant and comparatively unusual move within fantasy literature, which tends to provide explanations, if any, from the world beyond the portal. I'm thinking of Elidor, for example. I suggest that its presence in this children's fantasy paves the way for adult readers, similarly, to accept the irrational within literature. Despite the lack of acceptance of the supernatural in Western rationalist culture, fantasy like The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, which incorporates a rational justification for acceptance of the supernatural, allows to accept it in these sophisticated postmodernist texts as readily as Lucy does. Just as Professor Kirk authorises Peter and Susan to believe in the possibility that Lucy's story of the world beyond the wardrobe is true, texts like The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe have authorised generations of Western rational sceptic readers to accept the presence of fantasy, allowing the development, and especially the acceptance and increasing popularity, of fantasy and contemporary postmodernist writing.